Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fucking ears? What the fuckabilities? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Welcome to the show. Father's Day is this Sunday, and I'm not a big one for holidays, certainly not those contrived holidays, but give him a call, will you? Give him a call. Time is running out. Appreciate your family, your friends, and food. And try to do the right thing for other people, for strangers. Be empathetic. Be open-hearted. Don't be a dick. Stay off Twitter as much as possible. Get off of Facebook if you can. Breathe. Go enjoy a flower. Cook some things. Do some cooking. Yeah. Pet a cat. That's the list for today. Hold on. Comedy Store's calling me. Hello? Hey, buddy, what's going on? Yeah, put me in for Saturday, both rooms. Thanks, man. The idea that I had about taking a break from comedy is it doesn't seem to be happening. Doesn't matter. It's okay. Enjoy life if you can. Try to temper it. Stay involved. Do what you can. But don't let it destroy your entire disposition. Is that all right? I got kind of a big show today, so I'm not gonna ramble on too much. I'm going to talk to Jim Florentine, the comedian. I don't know. He just wanted to stop by and, I guess, talk about rock music. So we did that. It was fun. He's like a metalhead. I'm not quite a metalhead, but we meet somewhere in the middle. And, you know, he was just hanging out and he wanted to come over. And it's always nice to see Jim. After Jim, Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon are here. Now, they're married, and they have a movie coming out. The Big Sick opens in New York and Los Angeles on June 23rd. It's going to expand on the 30th and throughout July. But this is a big movie. Judd Apatow produced it. It's about their relationship. Now, some of you know Kumail from Silicon Valley, from The Meltdown. I've known him for a long time. He's been on this show before, but I don't know how many of you know that we had sort of a problem that was actually depicted in season 3 of Marin, episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Mad Mark, where I lost my shit on Kumail and Emily at the Meltdown here in Los Angeles. I just snapped and lost my shit. It was not good behavior. This is a few years ago already, but I didn't know if we had cleared it up. So there's a little bit of that coming up. Also, Kumail is in our book, Waiting for the Punch. It's available now for pre-order wherever you buy books or at WTFpod.com. But this was a kind of old school WTF in that I had to open with an apology. And this is for years ago, man. And I wanted to make sure we were cool. But I do remember being a little jacked up on caffeine. I remember going to the Nerd Melt to do the Meltdown show. And what happened, I don't know if I described this to you, is that, you know, it's hosted by Jonah and Camille. And, you know, I was waiting to go on. I had to be somewhere else, and they were going on and on. And I was losing my shit, and I got up on stage, and they got off, and I took a few shots, a few parting shots at the two of them. And then I got off, and Kumail said, you know, you can't make fun of me on my show. And I think I said, you fucking baby. What a fucking baby, you fuck. And then I threw a shit fit, and I said I wasn't coming back. That's some grown-up shit right there. Dave Anthony witnessed it. It was not a shining moment for me. And I held on to it for a long time. And then when I decided to make it a storyline on Marin, I asked Kumail if he would play himself. And I had an intention there. You know, I'll get into that with him, and you'll hear it. And Emily, his wife, has always been nice to me. She's written on a few shows, and she used to run the Meltdown show, and we've always gotten along. So I felt bad that I behaved that way in front of her, but I'm not sure if I'm not... I'm over it, but I think I behaved badly. Whew. There's still something wrong with me, people. So Jim Florentine, East Coast fella, funny guy, and again, he just wanted to come by, and I'm always happy to catch up with people I like. His special, A Simple Man, is available on his website, jimflorentine.com. He's at the Improv in Pittsburgh this weekend, and you can check his website for where he'll be in July and August. This is me and Jim Florentine, primarily talking about music. Jim, what are you doing out here? What brings you to Los Angeles, home of heavy metal?
Yeah,
it's got to be metal related, is it?
No, I just got, well, I'm doing this benefit thing Saturday, MS benefit. Me, Bill Burr, and Craig Gass are hosting. A bunch of rock stars go up. They jam.
Yeah,
it's a Richard Pryor presents MS thing. But I just come out to do stand up, doing the improv, and you know my management's out here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get away from New Jersey for a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, New Jersey's pretty great, but you got to leave sometimes.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, I got a kid. I'm making sandwiches in the morning. I'm helping with his homework. It's like,
Can you do that? Can you help with homework?
I barely. I mean, he's in kindergarten. I'm having problems. I haven't been in school in 30 years. Like, maybe, I don't know, maybe 33 years. So I have no clue. I've been, you know, as your comic, you just, you know,
yeah, and I know,
you're out of that world.
Oh, yeah. I was out of that world when I was in that world. If I had a kid and I had to go do algebra, there's no fucking way. I got an E in algebra. They made up a grade for me. There's a charitable thing.
Right.
But I don't know how parents do it. I just talked to somebody about that recently. I mean, I stunk. I'd be no help.
No, I just barely got by. I did whatever I had to do to get by. And now at kindergarten, the stuff is sent home like, this isn't done right. Like, he'll say, he's six. He's like, Dad, well, how do you do this? I go, I don't know.
Really?
He's like, you don't know?
Some
of the stuff is. Some of the stuff. But now.
Like, what is challenging?
Well, they haven't even got into the whole that Common Core math, you know, where they make it complicated to get to the problem. I haven't dealt with that yet.
Right.
Which I will be soon.
Right. What's the kindergarten level that's challenging?
It's just, you know, following directions. I'm not going to follow directions. You know, as a comic, we just march to our own beat. I don't listen to anybody. I'm my own boss.
There's steps. There's like, you know, you got to read the first thing and then the next thing to get the other thing.
I don't read anything. When I get something new, I just kind of, I'm like, I don't want to look at this pamphlet.
Yeah, you just find the quick start.
Yeah, exactly. Like, where is it? Just give me how do I turn it on? And then I'll figure it out along the way. So.
Oh, my God. So, but maybe this is a golden opportunity for you to learn these things finally. Do you ever look at it that way?
No,
maybe it's time.
No, I don't care. What do I?
Does the mom know what to do?
I don't know. There's not a lot of communication there.
But he spends time with her, right?
Yeah, we split it.
But
so.
You don't know if she's got a handle.
Yeah, well, I have him earlier in the week because, you know, as a comic, I work on a weekend.
Right.
So I got him most of the homework week. I got him Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and the Thursday. So I got to deal with it.
You're going to have to put some money aside for a tutor there, Jim.
No, I know. I just had some new neighbors move in that are that will definitely help. Yes,
oh, yeah.
They're right next door. So I told them.
They seem smart to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, they're Indian.
Oh, so that means they're smart.
Yeah,
well,
I told them as soon as I met him, I'm like, oh, that's great that you moved here because I got a son on how to do his homework, so we're going to be over here all the time. And they were laughing, like, oh, no problem.
That was, That was your hello?
That was my hello, pretty much. I'm like, hey,
Thank God.
That's my firewood. It, you know, it's on your property, yeah. And I'm glad you're here because I got a six-year-old and I don't know how to do his homework.
Oh, yeah, and feel free to take as much firewood as you need.
Yeah.
I'm glad they laughed.
No, they were totally cool about it, yeah.
Part of Jersey you live in?
I'm in, like central Jersey, about 45 minutes outside. It's near the Stress Factory Comedy Club.
Oh, yeah, you know, by New Brunswick.
Yeah, I grew up in that area.
Yeah, I remember you told me, because I was born in New Jersey. Something draws me to Jersey sometimes mentally. Like, as I get older, I feel like, you know, I need to go back somewhere. I need to know what my home is. I grew up in New Mexico, but, like, I'm born in Jersey. My parents are from Jersey. I'm, you know, Jersey genetics.
Yeah.
And there's something about it that, like, kind of makes me want to go back, but then I really think about it, and I'm like, is that where you want to retire? Jersey?
Nah, you probably don't. You probably don't.
I was just out there. I talked to Springsteen. I interviewed Springsteen out down the shore. Yeah, and it was kind of cool to be back in Jersey because I went to Asbury Park as a kid. My grandparents lived in an apartment building right on the fucking boardwalk practically back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that nice.
No, it's nice now. They really fixed it up, Asbury. Asbury's booming.
Really?
Yeah, they're building high rises, hotels. They got great restaurants.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Springsteen basically saved that city. They were ready to tear down the Stone Pony, Convention Hall, all of that stuff, but they made it landmarks.
Convention Hall.
Yeah, Convention Hall still there, where I used to go see concerts back in the day. I mean, it's a great little town, and they got great restaurants now.
I remember that was the first place I had soft shell crabs. That's what I remember.
Right.
I don't know why. My grandfather liked them, and I thought it was odd.
Right.
Eating the whole thing.
Yeah, probably.
And so, when you come out here, like, who are the rock guys on tonight? Do you get to hang out with your heroes or what?
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of the guys that live out here. Yeah, like, you know, Rudy Sarzo, who played with, you know, Ozzy and Whitesnake and Quiet Riot. I know Tom Morello. I'm a huge Rage Against the Machine fan.
Yeah, I've talked to him years ago.
He's great,
and
man.
He's an activist guy. You know, oh, yeah, he's involved
totally.
With
yeah,
shit.
Yeah.
I should get him in here at some point.
No, he's amazing. And, you know, he played with Springsteen for a while, for like three,
I know.
4 years.
It's an odd match.
Yeah.
It's an odd match. Like, he's one of those guys who's like, see, I've gone the completely other direction, but I was always sort of in this direction. I like straight ahead guitar. I barely like to know there are pedals involved.
Right.
Like, I like to hear the amp right up there. I don't like any much compression. I need it to sound like a guitar.
Yeah.
That's just the way I am. But that's not the metal sensibility generally.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true. But I always like a good guitar solo too,
right?
You know, we missed them in the, you know, 2000, late 90s with the new metal. There was no guitar solos.
No,
like, where are all the solos at? Yeah. Even Metallica put a record out where there was no guitar solos. Saint Anger.
I think that right. I talked to Hetfield about that, but I think that that Rick Rubin produced AC/DC album didn't even have many solos. If I'm not mistaken,
they, you know, a little one with Angus, but Angus is, I mean, I
so good.
It's 61 years old. I saw him twice on this last tour. It's
you
phenomenal.
Did without
yeah.
Malcolm?
Yeah, without Malcolm and without Brian Johnson. I saw him with Axl.
How was that?
It was amazing. Axl, the Bon Scott stuff, he nailed.
I bet.
And they went back deep into the catalog, you know,
really?
Stuff that Brian didn't sing with.
Like what?
What are they? Riff Raff.
No shit.
They did Problem Child.
Oh, that's
which
good.
I haven't done in a long time.
With Axl.
Yeah.
They do Let There Be Rock?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's when Angus goes crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like a 25-minute solo.
That is
like
guitar.
Spinning on the floor. And
oh, 61 years old.
61.
Did you see him when Axl was in the chair because of his leg?
No, he was out of the chair by then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Up and moving.
Yeah, I saw them with Guns N' Roses when he was in the chair. He was in the throne.
How was that?
It was amazing.
See, that's the weird thing. Like, I don't go to concerts hardly at all, and I probably should, but whatever the politics of why people do whatever people were saying about Axl, you know, playing with AC/DC or whether he needs money or he doesn't need money or whatever the fuck it is, it's still got to be good. He's a great singer.
Yeah, I mean, he's the one who called them, basically. They were auditioning singers. Brian, you know, had some hearing problems.
Right, hear bad, right?
He can't hear out of one, and the other one, he was like 70 or 80% deaf, and his doctor basically said, look, if you do any more live shows, you're done. You're going to have no hearing left.
Right, right.
So they were trying out different singers, and Axl was one to call because he's a huge AC/DC fan. He said, hey, if you guys need help, let me know. And I go, yeah, come down and audition. They didn't even think about him.
Yeah.
He went down there and, you know.
That was just for the tour.
Yeah, for the tour. So who knows what's going to happen. They finished like the last 11, 12 dates.
How many dates did Axl do with them?
I think 12.
Oh, man.
And we did some stuff over in Europe, too. So he probably did 20 total.
And Malcolm's done, right?
Malcolm's got dementia. I mean, at 61 years old or 60 or something like that. Yeah, he's in a home.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
And Malcolm ran the band, basically. Malcolm was the brains of the band.
So he's so. Playing guitar over there.
His nephew, Stevie Young.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, there's another young brother. Uh-huh. Who's, and he filled in for Malcolm. Malcolm had some, like, alcohol problems on a tour, like, in 92.
Years ago, yeah.
Yeah, so he got off the tour for, like, 30 days, and Stevie filled in for him.
So he holds his own?
He holds his own, yeah.
Well, you know, rock star behavior and any sort of trend, I don't know what you'd call it, but that, you know, becomes, everyone's under constant surveillance by just everybody. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you have a party, and all it takes is one guy or one chick to tweet something, and the party's over.
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, it's tabloid news. You can't, there's no, it's not even Big Brother. It's not even law enforcement. It's that asshole. Who is that asshole sitting in the corner with his phone that fucked everything up?
Yeah. A lot of times they make you check your phone in at the door.
At the parties?
Like, yeah, at the parties. So put them at the, leave them at the door.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because they don't want anyone taking pictures of... You know, say Axel's got a couple of girls hanging all over him. This guy's snapping pictures. He's going to sell it to TMZ. He'll be on there the next day. So you leave him at the... Prince, Harry or something like that was in Vegas, and he just let these girls take pictures of. It was a big scandal a couple of years ago.
I think
I
remember
that.
He was
naked, jumping on a bed. They were doing all drugs and shit like that. And he was just letting these crazy Vegas chicks just take pictures of him, and next thing you know, they were all over the place.
I guess the party's over.
When I had my bachelor party, I had it in my friend's basement. Yeah. He has a band. I hired a Black Sabbath tribute band to play.
Yeah.
And with like four strippers, and this was probably like 7 years ago, I made an announcement. I go, let's pretend this is 1975. Nobody has phones. Nobody's going on Facebook. Nobody's tweeting. And nobody's calling. Nobody's texting their wives, their girlfriends. Put your phones away. Put them upstairs. Let's just have a good time. I made that speech, and it worked out? Yeah, it worked out, yeah.
And nobody remembers anything.
Nobody remembers anything. There was nothing documented. I'm like, this is 1975.
We don't even know if it happened.
Exactly.
It was that good a party.
Yeah, I don't want you. I got my wife's texting me. She wants to know what's going on. None of that. It was perfect.
Have you been playing a lot?
I don't play. My son does.
Your six-year-old does?
Yeah.
How's he doing with it?
He's doing great.
Oh.
He's already sang at the Stone Pony on stage in front of 300 people.
No kidding.
He's an animal.
Yeah.
He's fearless.
And is he playing electric? Or?
He's singing. He's playing a little guitar, drums. He's good on drums. But he likes making up his own songs.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. My nephew's got a band, so he goes up at the end. He sings Let the Bodies Hit the Floor, this Drowning Pool song. And he goes up there. I'll show you a video when we're done. It's really fun. He's an animal.
That's a six-year-old song.
Yeah, and then he loves the Stones, so he loves Mick. He loves the way Mick moves.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, we go to music lessons every Monday, and like, there's always a video on of a DVD, and it was an old Stones video, and he's watching. He's just laughing the way Mick moves, so then he goes in.
Yeah.
He goes, I got a song, and then he's dancing like Mick.
Oh, my God.
He takes his shirt off, too.
He has
to rip his shirt. Yeah, he has to. He's like, it's cooler with my shirt off.
Oh, you got the right kid, huh?
I took him to Foo Fighters. He goes, Dad, I'm taking my shirt off. It's cooler if I watch it without my shirt. I go, of course. He's got a shirt off, yeah.
You lucked out on that one.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I got him into Sabbath, and yeah.
You got the right kid.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's nice when a parent like can bond that directly, because a lot of parents, I think they get those kids who are like, where did this one come from?
Yeah.
Why does he like this stuff? Who is this kid?
No, because even in the womb, I remember when my wife was pregnant at the time, I'd be on the road. She goes, I don't feel him kicking. I don't know. You know, she was all worried. And I'm like, just put some heavy metal on, like double bass, some Metallica, something like that. And she put it on. All of a sudden, he started kicking. I'm like, this kid's in the music already. In the womb, he was kicking like a double bass in the womb.
Is that true?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I swear to God. I go, put Metallica on. Put it up to your stomach. Put Enter Sandman on. And he would just start kicking away like he was just hanging, waiting for the music to kick in.
What'd you think of that new Metallica?
I love it.
I did, too. And I'm not a Metallica guy.
It's great.
I had to get up to speed because I had Hetfield in here. And, you know, I didn't grow up loving it, but, you know, I mean, I got it kind of, but so I kind of went through the stuff and then like I listened to that last one, I put it on in there and I'm like, this is solid. This is a good record.
It's great. You know, just that these guys are in the mid-50s, still writing great music.
Yeah.
Too, which, you know, a lot of the people gave up on Metallica after the Black Album because they cut their hair. Like, every guy with long hair got pissed when some guy cut their hair. I had long hair.
Yeah.
You would get mad. It's like, well, I got to go to court. Usually, when you had a court date, you had to cut your hair. Because even the ponytail wouldn't do. So I remember cutting it because I had to go to court. And everyone says, you do. But then when they cut it,
You
sold out. You cut your hair. I'm like, I don't care that they have short hair.
Yeah, listen to the music, you idiots.
But that's, so after that, people don't like, there's a whole fan base that doesn't like him after
just
the
about
Black
hair
album. Well, and the Black album right. got really commercial,
right,
you know, so I felt like they sold out, but this record is great.
Do you know them all? Do you know Lars?
I knew him, you know, when growing up in New Jersey, in Old Bridge, New Jersey, it was there was a record label called Megaforce Records.
Yeah,
this guy had a little shop in a flea market, and he would sell heavy metal records. And I was a little kid, and Friday when I got my paycheck, I'd go down there, all of us would go down there, and the guy goes, listen to this band, and he had this Metallica cassette.
Yeah,
No Life to Leather. He goes, I'm gonna sign these guys are the next big thing. I've heard this, I'm like, holy shit. So then he brought Metallica, when they were nothing, they didn't even have a record deal, brought them to New Jersey, and they were staying at the guy's house,
yeah,
in the middle of the neighborhood, and they right. were just drinking all his booze. He just had a baby, and he would call me, he goes, can you get these guys out of my house, take them to the mall? So I'm driving Metallica around in my mom's Zephyr at 17 years old. And they were, you know, because like they weren't showering, they were stealing, they drank their champagne like from, you know, his wedding night. They were saving that. Yeah. They just cracked it open one night, like, get these guys out of here. So I would drive them around. So I was hanging with them, and they would play these little clubs, like,
yeah,
you know, 2-3 nights a week. So I knew those guys right from the beginning.
And you still in touch with them?
Yeah, but they don't remember. Like, I brought it up to Lars. He's like, yeah, I think so.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, I want to comic. You know, you don't go up to comic. I saw you 15 years ago at the Funny Bone in St. Louis.
And you did a thing.
And we had a beer afterwards, yeah, and yeah. you said that my my girlfriend was hot, or I'm like, yeah. I think
sure,
I remember.
Yeah. I have a hard time remembering shit that happened a year ago.
I know, so I didn't even want to go. I did bring it up to him at one point, but I wasn't. You
That's
remember?
Too bad. I was that kid. That would be probably one of a series of kids that drove them around in some town.
Well, then, because there was older dudes in the neighborhood, so then they had a house. I was still living with my parents, and then they would stay over there.
Yeah.
My friend, who I'm still friends with to this day, Metallica, was living at his house.
Yeah.
And James Hetfield one night got so drunk, he puked in his bathroom.
Yeah.
And he was trying to sell a house. This was like 3 years ago, and it was on the market for like a year and a half, and he was just talking, and that guy said he liked heavy metal. He goes, Metallica used to stay at this house. He goes, James Hetfield threw up in that bathroom. He threw up, and the guy bought the house.
Come on.
I swear to God.
You put a little plaque there?
He's like, that's how he sold it. When he told the guy, he goes, James Hetfield threw up in his bathroom right
that was
here.
It.
And he bought that guy's like, I'll take it.
That's a small, like, what a lucky break, huh?
It was.
Yeah, just brought it up and, oh, who knew? That's fucking hilarious. So when you come out, do you go see shows?
Sometimes I'll see if there's something out here. I'll go show, but I like to do sets. I like to do the Comedy Store. And,
oh yeah. Yeah, I go there a lot. I see you over there. I've been on the road, so I don't like. Sometimes I'll just not work for a few days. Is that all right?
No, I do that too. My son, I take like early in the week off. I'm just like, I got at this point. It's like I can't obsess over it.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you go out and you're doing hour shows. If you're headlining an hour plus or whatever. And, you know, if you do 4 or 5 of those and you come home and you got 3 days or even 5 days, you're like, fuck it. Am I really going to be out of shape in 5 days?
No, I know.
Is it all going to go away in 5 fucking days?
Well, when you're younger, that's all you obsess about. You can't miss, you know, if you miss 2 or 3 nights, you feel like you're off.
I think 2 weeks, sometimes you get a little, you know, there's a...
There definitely is. I mean, I did 6 shows last weekend in New York City. It's like I didn't want to go out Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday to do sets. So the next set I'll do is tomorrow. It'll be like 5 days. But I was like, enough. I did 6. I'm like, I'm done.
Yeah.
I can't.
Right. Well, yeah, and it'll come back. But there's that weird moment where if you get away, and I've never really gotten away long enough for it to happen, but 2 weeks, or if you're only doing short sets and then you got to go headline, then it's sort of like, fuck. Can I do that?
No, I know. I know. That's always a problem because you do 15-minute sets.
Yeah, you're tight and, you know, you want to kill, so you don't integrate as much new shit as you want. And you can only really fucking spread out until when you get the hour. And then, like, you know, if you do too many of those sets and you haven't done an hour in a while, you're like, I don't fucking know if I have an hour anymore.
I have, you know, the iPhone in the notes section. I keep my whole full set in there.
Yeah.
So I have to look at it because I'm so used to doing the short sets.
Yeah.
So like tomorrow at the improv, I got to do a 45 to an hour. So I haven't done that in probably 3 weeks.
Yeah.
A full set like that.
Right.
So I got to go back and look at the notes. Okay, this is how I got to do it.
Right. How does it flow? Where's the direction? Where do I end? What's the middle? What's the end? And what's the beginning?
What's the beginning? What's the open? I know. But I love the process. I still love it. I've been doing it since, what, like 91. I still love coming up with new jokes and working on them and record them and listening back. And
the only time you can do
set.
It is doing those hours, though. Like, you know, like a lot of people think, you know, I'm not a guy that, like, you know, if I'm doing 15 minute sets, occasionally I'll do a new joke or two, but to really find out if something can live on stage, you got to do it in the middle of the big set.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And then if you've been doing it long enough, if it falls flat, you could be like, meh, well, fuck it.
Yeah. No, I'm at the point where I just did a full set. I just filmed something. So now I'm just going to these little restaurants, wherever, any little shitty place to do 45 minutes or an hour. They're like, oh, we can only pay you $100 to headline. We don't have a, I'm like, that's fine.
Yeah, I just need
really,
to
work you're
the
gonna
shit
play
out.
Here? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I'll do it. Yeah. And I'm doing this place like every 3 weeks by my house. It's a restaurant. There's a little place upstairs where they have little weddings.
Oh, they got a little room?
Yeah, a little room. And I do comedy to like once a month. So I'm doing like every 3 weeks.
It's the way to go.
I'm like, just give me $100. I don't even care about the money, and I'm just gonna do
work out.
That's great.
I used to do that here at a little theater. Like, I just with $5 ticket, I donated to the theater, tell my fans, and just like no expectations. I'm like,
right,
it's $5,
right? Yeah,
I'm gonna work through some shit. If you want to watch that, you're welcome, but I can't guarantee anything.
Yeah, like Colin Quinn's working on a new set, and he's doing it at the Peppermint Lounge, which is right by the in the Village Underground. I saw him last week or a couple of weeks ago. He had his notebook out. He was just looking at his notebook.
Just him like doing a long set?
Yeah, doing a long set. He's working on a whole
new... That's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know why we didn't think of that.
On a Tuesday night, $5.
That's what I did. Tuesday nights, for a couple months, hour, 2 hours, whatever, just to riff through shit. And I guess guys used to just do it on the road, but I think that's one of the reasons a lot of guys didn't ever build new material. You really got to just find a place where you can stretch out, where there's no risk.
Yeah.
Of anyone getting mad, lay it out at the beginning.
Yeah, no, because people do get mad.
If they pay $30, $40, and you come up half baked, which I'll do.
Right. Yeah.
But I know I'll save myself eventually.
But Carlin, we used to do that. Carlin would go out and do, just work on the material in small theaters, for a year, and then go record it. So he was doing it where he was taking a chance. Because people
for
would go
cheap
see
ticket,
him
though.
I can't remember, but I know people would go see him. They go, man, he was terrible. It's like he was working on, like he just was disoriented up there, and he was all over the place. He wasn't getting a lot of laughs. I'm like, he's working on a new set, but he would do it in the smaller theaters.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's the only way to do it. So what do you got going on? You got a special out for a while now, right?
Yeah, I put one out in December called A Simple Man.
Yeah. And what are you working on recording now?
Just working on a whole new set. I just recorded
with a plan.
Yeah, well, I recorded it. I did another special I filmed in January. It'll probably come out later in the year.
Where's the other one on iTunes?
Yeah, it's on iTunes, Amazon, wherever you.
So you just self-released it?
Yeah, I just self-released it.
How's it doing?
It's doing great.
Great.
You know what I mean? It's at this day and age, if you could do it and you could finance it yourself and do it cheap.
Yeah.
All the royalties that are coming in through. I mean, Sound Exchange.
Sound Exchange. That's the greatest thing in the world.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, I got more play. I don't know how much play I'm getting, but you do to get those quarterly checks. And you're like, what?
March 31st, a new one's coming.
Great.
It helps when you pay your taxes on April 15th.
I just like what was your experience? The first time I got notified by them, they'd already been around for like 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And they got this notification. I'm like, this sounds like bullshit. What is this? And I checked it through and it's a real thing. So that first check was like a lot of money because it was like for 6 years. And I'm like, what? That's fucking amazing.
Yeah, because then they went back to like 2004, basically, and went back and then if you own your stuff, like I put these prank call CDs out back in like 2001 to 2008.
Yeah.
But they weren't even on a label.
Yeah.
I just put them out and whatever. And, between the internet and Sirius and XM playing and stuff like that, they went back and got, if you own the master, you got a royalty off of that too.
So that payout good?
Oh, yeah. I'm like, holy shit. Who would
have
thought?
Free money. Yeah.
Yeah. So every like 3-4 months. So even if you put out, you put out an hour material, even if you don't really make it back through whatever avenue, through iTunes, whatever like that, you're going to get it in the royalties. I'm hearing rumors that the eventually like the Spotify's and the Pandora
will go through Sound Exchange
and YouTube. Well, they go through it, but they pay like pennies.
Right.
But eventually they're going to have to start paying like the real rate that Sirius is paying. Like Sirius held off on that for a long time too. That's where we're getting those checks. When they merged, Sirius and XM merged, part of the merger deal is like you got to start paying royalties. So now you just pass it along to the consumer. You pay $150 extra a month.
Right.
They got 31 million subscribers.
Still?
Yeah. And it's just growing and growing. So everyone pays $150 a month to pay the royalties for the artists.
Is it growing and growing? Are you on the air over there regular?
Yeah, I do a show on Ozzy's Boneyard, a weekly radio show.
And how's that do for you?
It does great. I get to plug my gigs. They pay me shit.
But you go in the city to do it?
No, I do it right from my house.
Oh, really? Yeah. And then you just upload it?
Yeah, I just upload it. I just do five or six breaks in a two-hour show.
What's
pick my
show?
Own set list. It's on Ozzy's Boneyard.
Yeah.
It's on the Hard Rock channel. Yeah. It's called Metal Midgets.
So you just host a music show?
I host a music show, 2 hours. I do 5-6 breaks. I pick up my own songs. I just go through my iPod. I'm like, oh.
You ever have people over the house with you doing it?
Once in a while, I'll do, like, I'll go to a concert. I'll do them backstage. They'll help me co-host it.
Yeah.
I'll do that, something like that. But I pretty much do them by myself. I go to, you know, the AC/DC Power track, and I go, I think I'm going to play Give Me a Bullet.
Oh,
there's not one bad song that Bon Scott on record that they ever did.
It's like,
there's not one bad song.
It's astounding. It's just fucking great.
It's amazing. Yeah. Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. I mean, yeah. There's nothing, ain't no fun waiting around to be a millionaire.
It's just so, it's hilarious and sad that, like, right, like, the Highway to Hell album, that was the one that was going to really put him over the top.
I know.
And then he just fucking dies. But Back in Black, that's a good record.
That's unbelievable that they could pull that off. They got bigger as a band.
Yeah, I kind of lost him after that a little bit. I listened to it because Dino gets me into it, and I listened to the Brian Johnson records, but I don't, for some reason, I'm really wired for the Bon Scott records.
Yeah, absolutely. But Brian had big shoes to fill and did a great job.
Sure. No, I like a lot of those records. I like Back in Black a lot, and I listened to some of the other ones.
Back in Black's just a masterpiece.
But just the thin, sort of like the raw production of those Bon Scott records before Back in Black, all those other ones, it's just so pure.
No, I know. I mean, you know, Love Hungry Man, Night
I love
Prowler.
That song. Night Prowler. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just unbelievable.
Yeah, Beating Around the Bush.
Walk All Over
Touch
You.
Touch Too Much.
So good.
All right, we could do this all day. It's good seeing you, Jim.
Absolutely, man. Good seeing you, too.
Jim Florentine, again, jimflorentine.com. For the tour dates, Pittsburgh this weekend at the Improv. So, Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon are going to be here in a second. And we're okay. Everything's okay. What I do want to say is the movie is a special movie. It's an emotional movie. It's funny. But it's the story is so unique that you know it had to have been true for the most part, as I find out. And it was well performed and well written and funny, and I squirted out a few tears, which I can do during a commercial, but that's not the point. I enjoyed the movie, which made it even better to talk to Kumail and Emily, because like I booked them before I saw the movie, and it would be hard for me to, you know what I'm saying. It's a good movie, and it's called The Big Sick. And it opens in New York and Los Angeles on June 23rd, expands to more cities on June 30th, and throughout July. And now this is me talking to them.
I watched the Q&A thing, the video.
Yeah.
I don't remember any
of
it.
A single thing, yeah.
It happened 5 days ago.
Yeah, with you guys?
We did a thing in New York that Judd filmed, like a live show.
Where was that?
The PlayStation Theater in New York.
So you guys were just in New York?
Yeah.
Doing press?
Yeah.
With Judd?
No, he was not there. He did not go to that show.
Judd didn't go with us. Judd set us up on a tour because he was like, I want to do, we'll do it. We'll all do stand-up. I was like, okay, great. And Judd's like, I'm not going.
He said, he's like, I've got a special coming out. And so I'm doing all these venues in like the next couple of months. So I'm not going with you. And we were like,
right.
Okay.
He was all nervous about his special.
Yeah. He still is.
Very much.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad he's finally gotten back into stand-up and doing what he always wanted to do.
Yeah, no, it took him this long.
He really does. That is all he wants to do.
Like, when he first started coming back around, you know, there was part of me sort of like, really, man? You're going to take up time?
You got to have this, too? Yeah, you're going to do this, right. too?
But, you know, he's really into it, and he works hard, and he's got some great jokes.
He gives a shit. He actually gives
a shit. It's not like, you know, sometimes somebody becomes a famous actor, and then they go to stand-up. It's not like that.
No, he's been a great joke writer forever. So, Emily Kumail, is that right?
Yes, sir. You know it.
I don't know if we're good, but I think that maybe I should probably effectively apologize for my my rude behavior a few years ago.
This is how we're starting?
Oh, yeah. I think we're good.
Did I see you, though? I feel like we just made up on Twitter. Did we actually have a moment where...
I ran into you at the Comedy Store a few months ago, not too long ago, and you showed me around, and you were just like, are we good? And I was like, yeah, we're good.
All right. Well, I'll apologize twice. I don't know that I apologized to Emily, because she saw the most of it.
I did. Yeah.
And then I wanted to, my way of apologizing was going to have you play yourself on my show, which you declined.
Oh, God.
That was my big idea.
First off, let me bring up, was given a tentative offer to play myself on the show that then was just disappeared and was rescinded.
It was better off. Because it wasn't like there was, like, you run into a problem at IFC budgets where that character didn't end up talking. And oddly, the extra that played you made everyone a little uncomfortable.
Ooh, in what way? What was her deal?
I don't know. She was an extra.
She was a bit extra.
Yeah, she was overdoing it a little bit. Yeah. But everything's good.
Just so you know, this is the first time that I've truly understood that was meant as like a conciliatory gesture.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing, I'm learning through Emily how to communicate better. I'm trying.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll mean something, but to the other person, it doesn't mean that.
It reads the opposite sometimes.
And so to me, I didn't understand that that's what it was. That's what it was meant to be until just now. So,
it was a roundabout way. I mean, there's no reason why it should be clear that I wanted you to relive me blowing up at you for getting mad at me for making fun of you on your show. I didn't enter that night with a good attitude, but that's good. So you never watched the guy playing you.
Oh, I've seen it.
It wasn't bad, was it?
Yeah, he did a good job. He did a pretty good job.
Fuck that guy. You and me are cool, but that guy?
And then I had a guy playing Jonah.
Yeah.
And then there was a minute there where Jonah he was going to be in the audience that we were going to
That's very meta.
Yeah, it didn't work out.
Well, I heard about it because they tell you there's a guy, Ali Maji, who's in Silicon Valley. He pulled me aside of a table read and he was like, "Hey man, do you and Mark Maron have anything?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "I just read these sides for Kumar Sanjiani hosting the Burn
Down." The Burn Down. That's
great. I was like, "Yeah, that might be based on me."
I always think that I make myself look like the big idiot, but that's not the same as apologizing. It didn't turn out well for me in that episode. Like,
that's
I didn't,
true. You were the bad guy.
Yeah,
I
didn't look good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was it. But you claim that you couldn't do it because of HBO.
That is absolutely true.
It's true.
They are not great about
it. It's still very difficult to be able to do anything, which is great. It's tough to complain. It's a great
job. I've been watching Silicon Valley, and it's sporadically. I've seen a couple episodes. You're always funny.
Thank you, Mark.
But I watched the movie, The Big Sick.
Oh, you saw the movie?
Why wouldn't I see the movie? Why would I talk to you? If I'm not going to, you don't think I would do that? You think I'd just have you over hey, what's up, you guys? Why are you here?
A lot of the comedy podcasts we've been doing of people we know, people are like, oh, these guys don't need to see the movie. They know them. That's why it's surprising.
No, I watched the movie. Oh.
How did you see it?
People are in charge of this.
You got a link.
I got a link.
Well, I always wonder how people are watching it. Is it on a laptop?
No. I put it on the link and then I put it on the Apple TV. So I watched it on a relatively big screen. Yeah. I saw it as a film. It did say, it had the weird
property.
Watermark on it for Mark Maron. But I got to say, it was one of those experiences where I didn't go, how well do I know you? You guys were always nice to me in New York. I think you gave me a ride home once from Bell House. And I know you from everywhere else. And it's always been good. But I didn't know the story. And the weird thing about the movie, aside from it was very well done, it's very well written, and I was very moved. And, I was tearing up and stuff. But I didn't know that story. And also, the fact is that what makes it so unique is that there's no way you could make it up.
Exactly.
Right. We were always because, we talked with Judd. Judd was like, should we put on a true, based on a true story? And we were like, I feel like this is a movie that when you watch it, even if you don't know it's a true story, you'd be like, I feel like this happened to somebody.
You'd be like, why would someone write this?
It's so specific.
So random and specific.
But it's so specific that there's no way. And it seems like even the stuff, because you both wrote it.
Yeah.
And it seems like even the stuff that happened in the relationship was so specific that it had to have happened, most of it.
Probably.
We took a lot of it from our lives. I mean, and then, what Judd and Mike, the director, did was like, all right, now it's a thing on its own. You've poured yourself out onto all these pages. Now let's make it a movie.
Right.
So there are, it's all from our things, but
Most of the major stuff is us, but then they would advise us on this is a great way to crank up the drama, crank up the stakes here. Who's the worst kind of person for Kumail to be stuck with here? So they were really great about helping us fictionalize it. But yeah, for the most part, a lot of it is pretty close to home.
Well, it was interesting because there are moments where, there's that one huge moment where, they decide not to move her.
Yeah.
And then you're on stage, but you don't know how it's going to go. You think like, oh, he won for a second. You think like, well, they listened to him. And then the other thing happens and then becomes terrible.
Yeah. Well, I
was that must have been one of those times where like you had to make a decision on how to make that moment land differently to just like you expect one thing and then it's not that.
Yeah. Well, what we wanted to sort of deal with that was the weird thing about this was when Emily was sick, those 8 days.
The real Emily.
The real Emily.
This one right here.
Hello. Yeah.
She comes out of it. Spoiler alert. When she's in a coma for 8 days, those days, it is a true emotional roller coaster. It's like great news, terrible news, unthinkably awful news. Congratulations. Oh, no, it didn't work. It's like every day. It's like six different things, and it's like a pinball. It's like completely different. You never know what's going to happen. So,
well, I guess for people who are listening who might want to see the movie, like the issue is that you guys are now married,
mm-hmm.
and you've been for a long time.
10 years, yeah.
Yeah, I remember. And this is your first real foray into big show business.
That's very true.
Well, you did a little producing on The Meltdown.
Well, she wrote for...
I've written for a few TV shows, but it's my first time writing a movie.
What'd you write for?
I wrote for The Carmichael Show for Another Period and for Crashing.
Why'd you stop doing those?
All of those, honestly, because of this movie. I started writing for The Carmichael Show, and then I had to leave to go film this movie in New York.
Because like when I first met you, you're like, I'm going to be working at a shelter or something.
Yeah, I guess I was a therapist for many years, and then kind of was like trying to figure out. I was writing like personal essays for women on like websites and stuff, and
right. I'm like Jane or something.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff, and then it's kind of slowly morphed into this. Yeah,
but was it like? Well, let's be honest. Now that we're all here and we're open, that's the only reason you stay with him, right? You're like, this is my ticket.
I got to ride this roller coaster.
Very few
this people, rocket ship. I don't know what do you call it.
Very few people who know us see me as the ticket.
Turned out you were. Who knew?
When we first got to LA, we were at a party, like one of these industry parties, and someone asked me in regards to Kumail, when did you get on board?
Right,
like,
right.
Like he was like some political affiliate, and I was like, oh, this town is disgusting, and I hate everything in it. And look at me now.
Oh, now you're going to love it. Now it's going to be nothing but love. After the premiere of this movie, you're like, this is the best town ever. Are you kidding?
But I still get angry a lot.
Yeah, how can you not?
Yeah.
Somebody told me yesterday, I forget the name of the producer. He was like, he gave someone an advice. He's like, whenever you get pictures taken, stand all the way on the right, because that way you're first in the captions.
Oh, really?
Like, there,
God,
write the
that's
names.
So gross.
I was like, that is perfect Hollywood.
I still can't figure out, like, I've spent my entire, like, I never think I look good on TV or in pictures or anything. And, you know, last couple years, I've just been trying to kind of, you know, get a face that works. Like, you know, like a smile that works.
You and
like,
Kumail have that in common.
What do you mean get a face that
you
works?
Like,
when you're on a press line or something and they're going like, over here, over here, over here. You just like, you know, how do I land on a face?
I'm trying to do the smize. I try and do the
it's
smile.
What is that? Somebody
texted
that or
just
tweeted that.
Smile with your eyes, because I don't like how my face looks when I smile. So I'm just trying to look not unhappy while not
I squint
smiling.
A little.
Yeah.
I squint a little because, like, I've noticed in photographs sometimes I'm a little open, a little too open. So
that can make you look psychotic.
I have family members
that have that issue.
The open thing?
Too open thing. It's like it makes you look a little over-medicated. It's kind of not great. Yeah.
And you don't even do it on purpose.
Not at all. No, it's very easy to do. I find I laugh in photos because I think most of the good photos of me, I'm laughing. So now in photo shoots, I'm like,
oh, that's good.
It's awful. It's so...
Like, they're supposed to be posed, and now every photo is like, why is he just doing that with his eyes, and she seems to be laughing
at something. Exactly. That's what we do.
So let's go beat for beat on this, like, without spoiling anything. So this characterization of your family, a traditional Pakistani family in the States, but adhering to the rules of the culture and of the religion, that's all pretty true? Was it... Yeah, like they would not have let you marry anybody outside of the religion or the culture.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that was the plan since I was a little kid. Like, since I was a little kid, my mom was like, I'm going to find a wife for you. Because my mom said, she was like, I didn't even graduate high school. She's like, all I have is you. you guys and all I look forward to. The next thing I have to look forward to in my life is finding you a wife. So it's a lot of pressure.
So that process that's captured in the film of actually auditioning wives or having them come over was a relatively real thing?
Not for me, but it was for my cousin. When I was a kid, I was in Pakistan and I had a cousin and she sort of was staying at our house doing these.
Yeah.
So it would every, you know, couple times a week, these like families would come and it's changed now a little bit. Now they actually, you'll meet the girl and then you sort of actually hang out on your own. But that's a...
They've opened it up a little?
Yeah. And the internet is now more involved, I would say.
Oh, yeah. There's all these websites that are basically like Muslim dating, but to get married websites.
But when... Okay, so... And how did it really play out in the way that it happened in the movie where you kind of had this weird meeting at a comedy club?
That is one thing that's exactly accurate, is that I heckled him at a show in Chicago.
And that's how you met.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had this great thing going, and then like he finds out that you were married. Is that true?
He did find out that I was pretty recently divorced. Yeah.
Recently divorced.
Yeah.
And then you find out that he can't marry you.
Yep. That's exactly right.
And you break up, and within days you get sick.
Well, this is different.
This is one of the things that we cranked up. What's more awkward than having a casual boyfriend by your bedside when you're really sick is having your ex-boyfriend by your bedside.
Right.
So in reality, we both knew this information about each other and we were just kind of like, well, let's keep going. I don't know what's going to happen.
Oh, okay.
But we actually hadn't broken up.
Oh, but it was weird.
It was weird. It was slightly weird because
I hadn't met his family.
Oh, Lord, no. They didn't know I existed. When they would call, he would be like, you have to be quiet. And I would just be like, this is such a bad idea.
And you hadn't met hers either?
I'd met her parents once for like...
Oh, like an hour.
Yeah. just met them very briefly once. Yeah.
And was the characterization of your parents, like your mom's like this Southern...
No, not at all. My parents are pretty different than the actress because when you get Holly Hunter to play your mom, like you're not going to let Holly Hunter be Holly Hunter.
She was great, but I'm from
North Carolina, and both my parents are very sweet, kind of stoic Southern people.
Oh, okay.
And so it's just more interesting to have them be Ray Romano and Holly Hunter bringing all their
sort
like,
of
fun
like
stuff.
A neurotic kind of
bad dad jokes.
But they were great.
Yeah, really
I always
good.
Like when Ray acts serious.
He's the best.
Isn't he great?
Yeah.
So good.
He's like, you know what I love about him? Always there's like a melancholy to him. He's always like
very hard on himself.
Even
Ray.
On his show, it was like he just if he felt so sad.
Oh no, like if you get him going, if you let him be hard on himself, it's like he knows where that is.
It's kind of oddly comforting, as successful as he is, he's still like not altogether pleased with like how he's doing things or how he's handling things.
Well, he likes to act. I mean, he likes to challenge himself that way, you know? And they were both great, and your family was hilarious.
Yeah, well, my dad is played by a Bollywood legend.
So he is? What's his name?
We brought in a ringer.
You did?
His name's Anupam Kher.
Yeah.
Our movie was his 500th film.
500.
But to most American audiences, be like, who's the new guy?
Yeah.
I know. Well, that happens with people in interviews.
How'd
are like,
how'd you find him?
How'd you find him? Like, I didn't like discover him while he was cutting my hair or anything. That guy's the Robert De Niro of India.
So you've known that guy all your life?
Yeah.
I grew up. So, and when we started writing, from the beginning, I was like, I wanted to be him. I think he'd be great. He kind of looks like my dad.
Yeah.
And then I asked my dad, who do you want to play you? And he said, Anupam Kher. So
as a joke, probably.
Yeah, he didn't think we would get out of
But and so it was, you know, and then I showed Judd and Barry and Mike the other I showed him clips of him and I was like, I think it should be him, and they all were like, great, but they were like, we'll make him an offer, but we have to set a 3-day limit because he's not gonna do it and we're just gonna waste time. I got a phone call from him that day from India.
Really?
Yeah, he just called me directly.
Oh really?
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm in?
Well, he had notes. Yeah, he called with notes.
Uh-huh.
He was like, this. So Emily and I quickly like rewrote, sent it to him that day. And then he called and was like, I didn't even read it. I just wanted to know that you would do something.
Which, by the way, is a good move. Like, how hard are they going to like work to get me?
Were they good notes?
They were. They actually made the character much better.
He's really, really...
500 movies in, he knows what he's doing.
He's finally figured it out. You know what's cool? Like that... Oh, I don't know. This is kind of a spoiler.
What?
Well, the scene where... For instance, there's a scene in the movie where I tell them about Emily.
Yeah.
And originally, to me, that scene was always like, I sort of take my stand, I tell them everything, and it's supposed to be this like, here we go, this is my point of view.
Yeah.
the day before we started shooting, he was like, it feels weird that you say all this and I don't say anything. He's like,
yeah. The mom had lines at one point.
Right.
Yeah,
he was like, I want to say what I want to say. And Emily was like, what would you want to say? And he says, I want to say that, you know, you're not giving, you still have to care about your family, your friends.
Right.
The American dream doesn't mean you don't give a shit about anybody else.
Right.
And yeah, we talked for like 20 minutes, and then I wrote two different versions, a long version and a short version. He was like, I'm doing the long version. And I was like, let's do this.
Yeah.
And that's what you see.
And I think that changes the movie so much because you see both our perspectives. And honestly, writing the movie, writing my parents' perspective helped me understand it more. And we're closer. And I hadn't anticipated that.
That you would have a new revelation about your
a new understanding about
your current relationship or what happened then?
Yeah, well, because here's what it is. You know, I always saw my parents as my parents. I was like, oh, they're done. They're the people they'll always be. But in writing this and then in talking to them, they're changing and growing and evolving. And they're in America. And they love it here because it is a lot safer. Well, the last few months have been a little tricky.
Yeah.
But to them, I see the struggle or the work they have to put in to try and protect their cultural identity,
right,
which I think is their identity. And how do you be who you are in a culture that's very different? In a culture where, in a big way, what you are is demonized and undervalued.
Yeah. Right.
So I see all that with them now, and I understand, you know, that they're dealing with shit the same way that we all are.
I think you also stop seeing them as bad guys. Not that you ever fully saw them as bad guys, but like they're not like these people trying to keep you from doing what you wanted to do. They've got their reasons for stuff, and I think that maybe wasn't clear to you until we were working on this.
Right, and you didn't really deal too much with the demonization except in that quick exchange with Ray, which is that an old bit of yours?
No, it's not.
That was a great joke.
Thank you.
I honestly keep joking. We made the entire movie so that Camille would have an excuse to make that joke because he couldn't make it on stage. Ages himself ever.
He couldn't.
No.
But you had it in the bag? You were sort of like,
no,
it was around?
It was just a line that we had.
It was just like a room bit. Yeah, like a life bit.
It was great. It was a standout joke.
Thank you, Mark.
But wait, but you suggested that, has there been problems in the last few months for you or your family now that the cultural climate has gotten worse and more heightened?
I talked to my mom a lot.
Where are they?
They're in New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
They've been here about 10 years. And to them, when they came to America, they were like, it was such a relief. Because, you know, for them being there, it's very dangerous, a lot of crime, all that stuff. It's also a wonderful place, Pakistan. So I don't mean to cast it as this
hellhole.
As this hellhole. I really don't. But it is a lot more stressful,
yeah,
a lot of corruption. So when they came here and they saw like everything works so well, you always have electricity, the water is clean, you don't got to pay somebody off to get a driver's license, you know, cops can't just stop you for the most part.
Yeah.
So to them, they were like, oh, finally, we made it. We got here. This is great. And then when this was happening, my mom was like, where else are we going to go? She was like, we already came here. It's like hard to talk about. She's like, we already came here. She's like, I don't know. We're getting old. Where are we going to run to next?
Right.
And I was like, Mom, I don't think you'll have to run. I think it'll be okay. But they are, you know, it's kind of shaken her world a little more than just, it's not just that she's like, oh, I feel unsafe. Her reality has changed. Because to her, America was like this.
This one, yeah, it was like a safe,
right, that democracy could take such a profoundly disconcerting
turn. Yeah.
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 But on the flip side, she and I are text a lot more than we used to, and she's gotten a lot more. A lot of people have reached out to her and to your family in general to kind of let them know, like, this isn't us. I promise, like, everything's okay. And I think she was like that. That was lovely to see that, like, in the midst of all
support,
everything that's happening, there's like support there.
In her neighborhood and with her friends.
Yeah.
And
like,
great.
You know, from like my family was like calling to apologize. And it's like,
oh, wow.
What a weird, like,
sorry for what our country
did.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it's also like, that's a weird thing to do too. But it's like, I hope there's like some silver linings in there somewhere of like feeling like you have a good support system. But yeah.
Well, I think that like a movie like this, though, also, you know, is something that celebrates what, you know, America should be.
I think so. I think that's right. Yeah.
And that, you know, the struggles of it, like they're, you know, it's sort of menacing that when, you know, when your family says that you're not going to be, that we're going to disown you, if you do this. I don't know how much that was played for dramatic effect.
I mean, that was the understanding my whole life, and I know people from my family who that has happened to.
It stuck?
It's interesting. Only very recently have those people who are like a generation above me have started sort of getting back in contact, and I think they've reconnected and become a...
After marrying people outside of the religion.
And having kids and stuff.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, and it took like decades and decades, and now I think people are getting older, and they're like, "This is my brother."
They're reevaluating, yeah, the decisions they've made.
It's not that thing that my family is getting less strict. It's just like you get old, and you're like, "I miss my brother. I wanna talk."
Well, that's
to him.
A funny thing a therapist said to me years ago was that because I was having trouble with my parents, he said you can train your parents.
Yeah,
and I'm like, really. True. And he goes, yeah, you don't have to talk to your parents. And the thing is that eventually they'll want to talk to you.
Are we there yet?
With my parents?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, too much.
Too much.
But that was years ago, but it was a very sort of insightful thing.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, they can call the shots up to a degree, but at what you get to a point, which you did in the movie, where you're like, you can think of it however you're going to think of it, but you're still my family and I'll see you later.
Yeah. I'm a grown up and now you're going to have to reckon with me as an adult now.
Yeah, we're going to have to negotiate this.
Which I started doing with my parents when I was about 15. So they're unfortunately hardcore, like trained that like, I'm just going to do what I'm going to do and you're going to have to be okay with it.
Right. And it worked out all right.
Yeah, it worked out great.
Well, the negotiation thing is interesting because what we're negotiating with, not everything has to be part of your relationship with your parents. There are certain things that you disagree on or whatever it is that you're like, you know what? I'm just going to take this out of our relationship. And it's just not going to be how we relate to each other.
Right.
So for a lot of the stuff that we disagree on, I feel like we haven't discussed it, but it feels like we've both sort of taken certain things off the table.
Right. Just put it in a Tupperware
container.
It's
like how some people don't talk about politics.
Yeah, I think a lot of families have experienced that now, like going home and like being like, if we are going to get along, we're going to not be able to talk about politics.
Right.
Yeah.
So your parents ultimately, their love for you transcended the adherence to tradition.
Yeah, I think it really helped them that they were here, so they were kind of cut off from the rest of the family. Like,
there was no pressure, you know, like familial pressure.
There's not as much pressure.
Right.
Yeah, because I remember the way that they would talk about the people who had married outside, and I was like, I would never want to bring that on my parents because it's pretty vicious. I will say that in real life, when I told them about Emily, it was a similar situation where Emily was very, very sick and she was still in the coma, didn't know what was going to happen. So when I told them in real life, my mom was like very concerned about Emily and is she going to be okay? And would like sort of check up on her. And then when Emily became okay, that's when she got really angry.
She had a heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She doesn't want anyone to be in pain or sick.
But now that we're out of the woods.
Yeah, yeah. Get rid of her.
And she also understood that, you know, if anything, it's my fault. It's not Emily's fault. So she's never blamed Emily for anything.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Was able to separate her disappointed with me from the person that is Emily.
Well, yeah, I thought the whole the whole idea of developing a relationship with her parents in the film, because of this dire situation, and then adding the fact that they knew that you guys had broken up, and then how that evolved. I'd never seen that before. You know, that's an interesting situation.
And I do think it's true, and we don't really talk about when you do fall in love with someone to a certain extent, you kind of have to court their family too, and that's a relationship of its own.
Yeah,
and not that it always affects, you know, the relationship you have with the person, but it is something we all have to contend with.
Right.
And I hadn't. Yeah, you don't really see that in movies a lot.
Who was the woman that played you?
Zoe Kazan.
Yeah, she's good.
She's great. Great. Yeah,
that was great.
Job.
You did a good job. You know, Kurt did a good job. Kurt Bronwer. Bo Burnham.
A.D. Bryant is great in it.
Yep. Yeah, Bo was real good. What made you cast Bo?
That was Judd.
Yeah, and Bo is a friend of ours, and we're fans of it.
Yeah.
But he was one of the first people that Judd was like, it should be, because Judd has worked with Bo before a few times and is a fan of his, and was like, you know, put Bo in. Bo should be one of your friends. So he was the first one we cast. of that group because we know we wanted three people.
And Judd was the executive producer.
Correct.
But the producer, but he was hands-on in that, you know, you showed him drafts and he had notes. And
absolutely. For about 3 years, every couple of months, we would take him a draft and he would kind of give us
that
notes.
That long, huh?
Yeah. And then we would go off and a few months later, we would bring back another draft. And yeah, it was an arduous process for sure.
Oh, wow.
He put you through the ringer in the best way. Like, it made it way better.
And I thought that your mom was great. Your brother was funny. Yeah. You know, all the supporting roles were really good. Even the few women that were coming and going.
Yeah.
A lot of those girls are really, really funny comedians also.
Oh, yeah?
Bella Lavelle, who's the girl who's like featured most in the movie.
The one you walked to home?
Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah. She's like, we were doing that scene and we were like, oh, you're going to be like a huge, huge star.
Behind the monitor, I was like, maybe he should end up with this girl and we should just rewrite the movie.
In life? Or?
Well, no. And Mitra Johari is also, she's one of the girls. There's a lot of really, really funny women that kind of come through that I'm glad they all got little moments.
Here's what I learned auditioning these people. There are so many fucking great actresses.
I know. And they're all here.
Oh, yeah. In New York, we shot this in New York. So in New York, you also have access to all these like legendary Broadway actors.
Oh, they'll come in. Yeah, it's so wild to have them in there.
And
yeah.
You're just like tremendous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like the guy who plays the Montreal comedy
Booker. Oh, yeah, who is that guy?
Sheamus.
Jeremy Sheamus.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What was his name in the movie?
Oh, it's Bob Balaban is the name of the movie.
Because we kept saying, it's got to be like a Bob Balaban type. So gradually he became Bob Balaban.
You couldn't get Balaban?
I don't even know if we went out to Bob for that. We were like, but what's in our brains? We kept going, the Bob Balaban guy.
But right. Jeremy Sheamus is like an amazing Broadway actor, and it's such a small part, but you really feel...
Yeah, yeah, he was great.
You feel that guy, you know? And I remember when we were in Chicago and the Montreal or Aspen bookers would come and like judge you and say
when
this.
Little lectures and stuff when they come and give like classes.
We wanted to show what that was generally like, you know, Hollywood movies are always about like follow your dream, do it, you can succeed. So we wanted to have the Kurt character, whose name is Chris in the movie, be the guy that like doesn't make the move, doesn't do it.
You had two of those guys.
Chris Highsmith, the
Joe guy.
Yeah. Sam Highsmith, sorry.
Yeah. He had that one punt, the one hook, right?
Yeah, people say Sam.
Yeah.
Now, Kurt Brunneler wrote like 10 minutes of material for that guy to do as that character.
Oh,
and
really?
Only like 30 seconds of it makes it into the movie.
That was fun. Yeah, that all rang pretty true. And actually, that moment where you tell him to come to New York, he's like, no, I'm good.
You know those guys.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, from Chicago, there's a lot of guys where you're like, oh, you... So funny, just never.
Yeah,
never.
Every city has them. You're not exactly clear why they don't do it, but you know, in retrospect, you think like it might not have been the right thing for them to do it.
Totally,
it could have killed
100%.
Them.
100%. It could have killed them. And some of those guys are comedy is just the drinking is a more important thing, and comedy is just like the thing that they say that they're doing, but really it's like making sure they can go and drink every night
and have friends and have a social circle.
Absolutely.
And be known in a little world.
I've heard you talk about this on here, but when you're in another city and you're like, oh, this is the legendary guy, you gotta see him, this guy, and then you see him and you're like, this guy, that's the guy.
Right. Maybe he was better back in the Well, there's a couple of those guys where they had their time, you know, in the 80s
in
or
the
whenever.
90s, sure, like early 90s, yeah.
And you can kind of see it, but you know.
There's a sparkle there.
I appreciate, you know, I respect them. It's all very heartbreaking. You guys seem to be avoiding it currently. But there's no shortage of it, but I think you're out of the woods.
For now. Never out of the woods.
I guess not. Depends what your expectations are, ultimately.
Yeah, the woods are eternal. There are always going to be woods.
Yeah.
Always in the woods.
I don't always understand why people keep working once they've had success. But
Yeah, you do. You wouldn't stop doing this. You would.
Well, this is very specific. You know, this is like easy. I just walked you through my house, and you know,
you made
this,
me a great cup of coffee.
I made you a good cup of coffee, and it's my social life. It's really my functioning social life, and you know, it's just me and my partner. And we this could be the only thing I do if I want. So no, this stays. But you know, the kind of like, you know, the compulsion to do a new hour every year, and that, you know, like, oh, I better get up three times this week. I'd like to think I wouldn't have to do that, but
well,
I don't.
Why don't you not do it?
I'm gonna try.
You're gonna try to not do it.
Just for a week or two.
Just I can already see you talking yourself down from it.
Well, no, because like I just spent 3-4 months on the road. I taped a special a couple weeks ago for Netflix, and you know, and I've got this show premiering, and there's part of me that's sort of like, I want to take the time to figure out what the fuck I want to say next. Because sometimes you get into that new hour, either because you got to do a show or whatever. And it's not, it doesn't happen organically. You're sort of like, fuck, I got to get this together. I'm going to do it anyways, but I'd like to see what it feels like to do it on my own time again.
Well, because if I think if you're working a bunch, you don't have the life material to then write new stuff. Like you're not interesting enough to write new material, but they still, you're still expected to. And I think that's when you see real shit hours from people sometimes.
Well, yeah, because they want to keep it going. You get a window of opportunity to make the money. At a certain level of stand up, or you're getting the, you know, you're getting the deals. So how did you pick Mike Showalter direct it?
Yeah, well, my first job was he had a show on Comedy Central called Michael and Michael Love Issues.
Yeah,
and I wrote for that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we've just known him for years, and then we saw. Hello, my name is Doris. We saw an early
with Sally Fields.
Yeah,
was that all him? Was that David Wayne and him?
No, that was all.
It was
him.
All Michael.
Yeah, and when I saw that movie, I think we both had the same reaction of like, "Oh, Mike would be great at this because it's got such a lovely. It's really respectful to the character, but also like lets the character be funny in a way that's self-deprecating. But it never the tone is so great, and it goes from being sad and sweet to being really funny. I just thought it was so great, and I was like, "Oh, he can handle the weirdness of this movie and this story."
And it's not always so easy to shoot comedy and to shoot comedy clubs, and I thought it came out pretty good.
Yeah, well, the one thing we did was we never wanted to present. This is the trap I see, like some shows get into, where they want to present the stand-up as being like really good stand-up,
right?
And then you watch it. First of all, stand-up's so hard to translate to TV anyway, or to a screen. So you see it, and you know, there's been, I don't want to name the shows, but where you're like, oh, this is an amazing sketch, and you watch, and you're like, that's not that funny.
Yeah.
Like so, within the show, they're saying it's an amazing.
Yeah, game. It's supposed to be like genius writing, and you watch and you're like, it's not that good. So with our thing, we just wanted to present the stand up as it was and never present it as like, this is good or this is bad. Like,
no,
this is just some of it.
I liked it because, like, if you've been doing this long enough, there are types. And, you know, they were very familiar, you know, to me, just in posture. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like even when you just saw like Bo choosing to sit down, you know, and do me basically. And then that was like, that's my thing. I sit down and lurch. but like even when you just see Kurt like doing the pigeon bit.
Like very physical. Yeah.
Right, but like that's a type. And also I was happy that, you know, the back room felt organic. And then just the Sam guy. You just knew that guy. You didn't even hear all his jokes. You can barely hear any of them.
Yeah.
But just by you mentioning like he's doing another Sam joke or whatever. But the coming unhinged on stage thing, I don't think a lot of people know that really happens.
It happens.
It does. And it doesn't happen as much as it used to because people are nervous about
filming.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But like, you know, people used to like not necessarily emotionally coming unglued and breaking down, but certainly anger and that kind of stuff was a lot more prevalent when I was younger. People losing it. Because that's where you're going to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When everyone's watching you and you're like, I got all this pressure on me.
Yeah, fuck it.
Let that valve go.
I have bombed beautifully in some very important moments.
Yeah, totally, right? That I remember reading, like, when I was before I started doing stand-up, I was reading books about stand-up.
Yeah.
And they were like, they talked about, I won't name the comedian, but they were like, this comedian had a very important showcase and just had a horrific bomb. And it like, that shit hurts your career. I don't remember when it was, 2009 or something, when I did Bonnaroo. I've only done it once.
I won't go back to that thing.
I had one of those where still to this day, if I look in comments, something like previous to this movie, someone will be like, I saw him have the most horrific bomb at Bonnaroo. Like,
yeah, it was pretty intense.
But, you know, it's like, you know, that Bonnaroo situation, though, because Rocky will set it up like, it's great. It's air conditioned. It's a great city. It's the best situation for a shitty rock festival. And it may be a good rock festival, but you can't leave the grounds. Mm-hmm. It's hot as fuck. People are just coming into the air-conditioned comedy tent to relax. And it's the middle of the day. Everything is stacked against you other than air conditioning.
Yes. And then people come in to fall asleep.
Right.
They're there for a nap.
And like I did a set there and, you know, I knew exactly what was going on and I just wanted it to be over. But I think sometimes you enter those situations believing what the booker tells you and you're like, oh, it's going to be great. And then within 30 seconds, you're like, this is not great at all.
No.
And I'm fighting for my life 45 seconds. And not because they're hostile. They're just not. They're sleeping.
Well, these guys were hostile. Just started booing me.
Oh,
and
no.
Well, the problem, I think you hit it, is like sometimes in these situations, the trap is to try and win him over.
Yeah.
That's what you did.
You just want to say the words and get off stage.
Get out.
Just don't embarrass
Looking
yourself.
Looking at the watch. I'm not even going to finish that bit. I did my time.
It was a show with Robert Smigel. It was like a triumph show I was on. So it was, I think it was me, Amy Schumer, Smigel.
Soon, I think.
Was anyone doing well?
Nobody was doing well, but nobody did as awful as I did. And there were three shows. And after that show, Smigel was like, I'm going to put you up at the end of the show. I was like, I get it. I fully understand.
But the selling point always used to be like, don't you want to go to Bonnaroo? And like, I always was sold on that. But then I started to realize, like, you know, if I wanted to go, I'd just go.
Yeah.
Also, you don't want to go.
You don't really. Like, come on, you're going to hang out with a bunch of comics. I'm like, I can do that here.
And by the way, in a trailer, because the green room for the comics was like a trailer. And I was like, we're literally all just crammed into a trailer with one tiny bathroom.
Or you had to use the fucking honey pots, which I can't stand.
No, thank you.
The best one was always bumper shoots. The only one. Mm-hmm.
The shows
were good, but the concert's good. It's manageable. You can leave and you're in a city. You can walk around and see bands and like the headliners at a nice little stadium.
In mud. Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, Bonnaroo was just like, you couldn't get out. Like, it's like, what are we going to do all day? It's like, well, the van's not leaving. Oh, fuck.
That's right. And the van only leaves like a couple times a day.
You got like,
it's like Saigon.
Yeah. It just. Just and people were getting drunker and drunker.
We
had a great time. That being said, we did have a very fun
did
time.
Did we?
I had a great time. I didn't have to do stand up. It was awesome.
That always makes a difference.
It does.
Yeah, that was the first time I hung out with Thune and we became friends there. I guess that's the good thing that came out of it.
With Nick? Mm-hmm. How's he doing?
Great.
As far as we know.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think, and Showalter did a good job. You know, I've talked to him many times. We've had our ups and downs.
But what's your ups and downs with him?
Well, I think at different points in his life, you know, we didn't match up. You know,
you guys are both crackly guys.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, but did you have a thing against like the state guys, like these guys?
I did, sure.
Because
I'm that age, you know, and I, you know, when they sort of infiltrated the stand-up scene, I was like, the fuck, we got to deal with these guys.
What are they doing?
We were doing Luna at the time, and then they'd show up as stand-ups. All of a sudden, they all decided they were stand-ups. You know,
and they put on a show. Didn't they have a Stella live show that was in New York?
Yeah, they'd have me on that occasionally, but I resented them for then too. And me and Mike, I don't think Michael Ian Black and I have ever been completely recovered from whatever it is we do to each other.
I listened to an episode of you guys together and it was like tennis. It was
The live one or the one-on-one thing?
I think it was the one-on-one thing.
Yeah, we did all right. We're okay. I don't engage much anymore. But Showalter, like, you know, he's a difficult guy. He used to be more so, but then all of a sudden, like, you know, he gets sobered up, he's got a family, mm-hmm. and you know, people get older, it's just like your parents, like you're talking about. Eventually, like, what's the grudge?
Yeah.
You know, what is it worth holding on to?
No matter what, these are the people you've known for decades now.
And you know them, you know, it's weird, even if you don't talk to them. Like, I had that realization recently that, you know, there's people that, like, I've known some of these guys for like, what, 25 years, a little bit. But like I saw a roommate of mine who, you know, from college who I hadn't seen in like 15 years. And you don't never know, you know, and I saw him and it was like, it was right there. It was not, there was no distance, mm-hmm. but there are those people. And then there are people that you see and you're like, I don't fucking think I ever knew you.
Yeah.
Who the fuck are you?
We're struggling to get through one conversation.
Right. Yeah. Like how do we, but like most of the people that I know from comedy, like I you know, I know enough. You know what I mean? Like I don't ever feel like, holy shit. I'm always pleasantly surprised. I'm rarely like, oh my God, you're a monster.
That thing is weird what you were just saying. Like I hadn't, you know, so I came here and a lot of my family I hadn't seen in like 15 years. And I had a cousin graduating last year. So I went up and my aunt came and I hadn't seen her in 15 years.
Yeah.
And it was like we were never apart. Like
because
we were pretty close and it was like exactly the same, like making the same jokes. You go back into that and it's great. But then sometimes, and I won't... Sometimes you run into people and you're like, oh, you're a douchebag now.
I didn't think
this was going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe you always were.
Yeah, that's the...
Who knows?
There's just some people that are wired into you and, you know, it's always familiar. But you still don't want to push it. You just hang out for a few hours. You don't spend too many days.
I don't need many new people, like, intimately in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't need new friends, for
I get people in here for an hour. I'm good. I'm good. It's great. I usually have conversations with them that they've never had before, or I've had. And, like, I feel like I know them. And I'm like, all right, great. Take care.
See you off into the night. I've gotten my film.
Yeah.
Intimacy achieved.
Other than this and stand-up, do you, like, go out to movies and stuff? Do you go see
in
movies?
Life?
Yeah.
What's your social life?
Oh, yeah. I'm dating a woman who's a painter. And yeah, we go to movies and we make food. And, you know, we go to art things. I was in New York. We, you know, went to Lincoln Center. You know, we saw jazz. Yeah, I do things, but I don't run with the guys anymore. I don't have a pack, really. If I need to check in with that, I'll just go to put in for work at the Comedy Store.
That's what's so great about
it. Hang out in the hallway for a few hours. Be like, I'm good for a little while.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. What oddly, though, I have not gone to alt venues almost at all in like a couple of years. Probably not since I had that thing with you. I've not. I did the first show at Meltdown for a woman's show, a monthly show. And she just, I don't know, she wanted me to do it. So I went and did it. I don't think I'd been there since I walked out.
Really?
That night on your show.
Well, we stopped doing that show.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if I could. I don't know why I've drifted from that, because I was always... I think there
they
was
love
a,
you.
Do they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I somehow decided that they didn't at some point.
No, but they just can't show emotions as easily. I think that's part of it.
They showed they love you by offering you a part on their TV show. Uh-huh. That's how they...
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I just like, if I need to work out, yeah, I tend to go to the store and just work out.
Which is great.
Because I do think the alt shows are more like hangs. Like, it's supposed to be like a cool hang more than it is like business.
Although the store and those places are a hang, too.
They're definitely a hang. And like, I think what's happened is I've come sort of full circle on the fact that, like, I think when I first got to L.A., I needed to do the alt shows. I needed to do any show. And I liked that there was this whole world of new comedy fans coming up. But then I did start to feel like... like, I didn't trust it as much as I just trusted the dirty old shitholes. Like, the dirty...
That's interesting.
Like, there was something about the audience that was sort of homogenized, and also their expectations were cute, and it was a little... Everyone seemed the same. Whereas you go to the Comedy Store, it's like, you don't know what you're walking into.
Oh, see, that's really interesting. So it almost seems like the alt rooms became less of a challenge for you, maybe?
Yeah, well, they were, and but I wanted to be part of it.
Yes.
But you go to the Comedy Store, and you can fucking be handed your ass.
Yeah, you have to win them over, whereas
you got to do the job.
Yes, yes, that makes sense. That actually makes a lot of sense.
I totally have that, where I'll, like, try out stuff at UCB, and it'll really kill. And even before I'll be at, you know, I saw you at the store, I try and go... a few times, and you get there and you're like, oh, I have all this material, and you look down, and even before you perform it, you're like, this isn't gonna fly.
It's just got no ending.
You feel that
it's not gonna land.
You just saying this doesn't have an ending is not gonna be the laugh that you want.
Right, in an alt room you could get away
totally.
Well, I hope the thing's a big hit, and you did a great job, and I love the movie, and it's good to see you, and I'm happy for your success.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, and what else?
I'm excited for Glow. I'm really excited.
Oh yeah, I am too. I have no like it was so interesting because I just took an acting gig because I wanted to try it, and now it seems like it's like wow, it seems like it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, Glow itself was like that. I loved watching that on Saturday mornings. Like when that I knew that TV show was coming, I was like, I cannot wait to watch this.
Well, it was really exciting on a lot of levels to do it, you know, because none of it was really on my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And I just come out of four seasons of my show, and it was just sort of, I'm just play this guy, and you get to see all these women do this work. Like, they really became wrestlers.
Yeah.
And it was like, in my mind, it's like, I'm just here to facilitate their show.
Beautiful. Yeah. So much easier.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So you hadn't really done any real acting until your show, right?
Right.
Did you take classes? What did you do?
I knew enough about myself to know that I was okay on screen and that like I could handle it, but I knew that I was going to eat it for a season. Like I knew that there was no way around not being stiff or a little stilted because I'd never been in that environment or working on TV like that. So I just sort of accepted that I'll take the hit and I'll figure it out. So I didn't take classes. But like, as I've talked to people in here, like Martin Landau and stuff, they're like, if I get another season of Glow, which that character was different than me, but it was in my wheelhouse. I'm not going to take anything outside of my...
We have to like really challenge your acting ability.
Well, like I'm not going to learn an accent. You know, I don't want to... Like I can be present and I can listen and I can do it. But there are other nuances. Like if I get another season of Glow, I'd like to focus on, you know, going deeper with the guy. But I think I can, you know, I do all right. But no, I never took lessons. It was just sort of learning how to be comfortable, I guess. And the thing is, like, and I think you figured it out, I don't know when, but, you know, there is a sort of like, when you enter a scene, when the cameras are rolling, there's a, you know, you feel like it, to find the room to make choices and be funny and take pauses, It takes a little while.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like where you're like, I'm okay here. And like, you know, let's let that sit for a second. And, you know, do that, but not be thinking that.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I always have, when I was first starting doing it, I would be in a scene and I would be like, what should I do with my hands? And
right.
then I'm fucked.
Yeah, right. It's the worst.
Then you're fucked.
Yeah, like, what do I do with my hands normally?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then even that doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
And then all you're thinking about is your hands.
Then you're fucked. Then yeah. it's
and
over.
And then you tear your eyes out.
But I was talking to Ray about this just a couple days ago, or yes, I don't know. But I was like, because he really is such a great actor, I think. And he's, he's got another show coming out now. So I was like, did you ever take any classes or anything? And he never did. Like,
yeah.
He did, like, before the first season of his show, and just hasn't since then.
Yeah, I remember. Like, there was a woman we all worked with in New York.
Right, she passed away, right?
Oh, did she?
Oh, maybe it was he had a guy, and then he had the woman, yeah.
What was her name? Caroline Ray used to use her. They'd all use
the comedians went to her.
Right, wow. to prepare for auditions and stuff.
You know,
Alice was her name, I
there's
think.
There's a lady like that now that like I go to that Ron Funches goes to.
Oh, really?
Or Lester.
Out here?
Yeah, Kurt goes to her.
Oh,
yeah.
really?
Yeah.
Just to get you like a coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's good because she knows how to work it with comics, so it's not like all the shit that we would think is lame. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because they know that we've already got this skill. Like, we can be in front of people, we can do, you know, we can act because we do an act.
Yes. Right.
So there's not a lot of that.
Being comfortable on camera, you don't have to work through that stuff.
Right.
It's like the toolbox of like how to actually like access stuff.
It's just weird. It's weird. I'm watching myself and glow. I'm a little sort of like, I don't want to talk about how I feel about how I did because I'll let other people experience it. But like in my mind, like if we do another season, I'm going to challenge myself a little bit in ways that people might not even notice, but me.
No, but you'll That's notice cool. it. When you watch yourself, you can say it. Like, were you like, oh, I did a good job on Glow? Or were you like...
No, there was definitely scenes where I did a good job, but there was moments where I'm like... Like, but then you sort of like, is it the cutting? Is it, you know, like,
sure.
because that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
Like there's a, you know, it wasn't bad, but like I get right back to where I was and I'm like, what am I thinking right then? There was one like maybe 10 seconds on camera where they kind of come in on me and I'm like, you know, I knew that was what was going to happen. Like I knew what was supposed to happen there, but I wasn't thinking about the right thing.
Yeah.
Now, is anyone else going to notice that? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. I can sometimes watch myself and I can remember like, all right, this is how I felt that day.
Right.
And I could see that when I see myself.
Right.
I could see myself knowing what not to do with my hands.
But you're the only one who knows that because you were in your body. But the thing is a lot of times we do stand up and we're fucked up in our minds, you know, but we're up there doing it.
I know, and you can't tell.
No, you can't. No one knows.
I have this thing sometimes where, like, I'll be, like, riffing or something, or there'll be a scene where it's an improv scene.
Yeah.
And then I'll watch it in the two-shot or whatever, and I'll be like, it took me so long to figure out what to say next. And then I watch it, and you're like, oh, it doesn't feel like that.
No.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, you got to leave that space. Like, there's with me... Like I do that, I do that series with Swanberg, with Joe Swanberg,
uh-huh.
The Easy, you know, where mm-hmm. every year he's going to revisit these characters, and I just shot another one, and that's all improvised. Like it's very loosely outlined, so you're just in it, and you give me that freedom, I'm just going to like, you know, just you know, and from doing my show, you know that you don't have to do, just relax,
yeah,
take a pause. You know, don't, you know, it's not, that's not how people talk. But sadly, it is sort of the way I talk. Like, I use my hands a lot. And I, you know, like, if you, like, me being myself on camera, you'd think, like, why does he keep using his hands like that?
But you're literally doing it right now. Yeah,
exactly. I do that.
Yeah.
You know, I see pictures of my hand out like this. And I do this almost every conversation I have in here. What am I doing? I don't know, but I'm doing it.
Yeah. It's how
the way I am.
The thing I noticed was because we edited a lot of our movie too, so we watched a bunch of takes of everybody, and I watched a lot of takes of myself. And the big lesson I learned was like sometimes just say the fucking line.
Yeah.
You don't gotta put anything
on. Zhuzh on it. Doing a lot of zhuzh.
Even if you're supposed to be sad or whatever.
Yeah.
Just say it because like when you're actually sad in real life, you say stuff. You know you're sad. You feel sad, but the line doesn't have to come out as sounding sad.
Like, yeah. You're like making this sound.
You don't have to have a big wind up for the pitch.
Just,
you know,
just fucking say it.
Well, good. See, we're all learning. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that worked out. We're all good. The movie's good. The Big Sick. Go see it. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. I don't think I'm going to play guitar. It's just like it's not plugged in. It's not set up. I know it's heartbreaking to a lot of you. Do I want to play? I don't even know if I have one that has good strings out here. Hold on. I'm plugging it straight in to the dirty old man, the 58 Fender Deluxe, and the guitar, the one that I have been keeping from you, the best guitar I've ever played in my life, and I've been cagey about it, not sharing about it, is a Gibson 56 reissue of a 56 Deluxe gold top with P90s, for those of you who give a shit. That's what this is. That's what this sound is. And I had to go back in the house to get my tuner, because I used to have two, but Jay Maskus stole my tuner. And if I ever get together with some people to play, which is the plan this summer, I want to play with some people. I need a combo. I'm looking for a combo out here in Highland Park. I need guys that are good, guys that are better than me. I'll rent the space with no objective other than to play. We'll pick some songs. We'll play them. I don't know how to play with other people really that well, because I never have. But I'm reaching out to professional musicians to play for nothing with me for fun. How could you not want to do that? That was loud. Look at those levels. How about now? Boomer lives! Is that better?